Senate Higher Education Policy and Budget Division will come to order. I'd actually like to take Senator Berglund's bill first, and then Senator Clark, Senator Wicker, and then Senator Hahn. Senator Berglund, why are you here?
Madam Chair and members of the division, this is the health care reform bill that's been moving through the Senate, and I'm not going to go through all of the various parts of the bill because I know you're pressed for time. What I would like to say is that the bill is designed in a way that we believe by 2015 it will bring down healthcare spending by about 20% over where it would have been otherwise if we hadn't done anything. There is a savings recapture mechanism in the bill so that a third of the savings can come back to the state for reinvestment purposes to carry out the functions and the needs of the reform effort. One of the things that the reform effort needs, and one of the things we need no matter what else we do, is that we do need more primary care physicians and nurses out in the field practicing medicine in the state of Minnesota. It is no secret that there is a direct relationship between the number of primary care physicians that a state has in relationship to their population and the health care costs per person in their state. Because when services are provided at the primary care level, it is less expensive than when you have to rely on specialists. We do have a shortage a more dire looming shortage because of expected retirements in the medical field of primary care physicians. We have other things in the bill to allow primary care to be able to provide more value to the system and thereby be able to be greatly rewarded by the system. So that is part of the problem also, that primary care doesn't tend to earn as much money in the system as other specialists do. But we need more to be graduating. And so that's the part of the bill that brings this before your division. It is asking for money to be appropriated from this health savings account in recapture account into the Mayo Medical School, the Duluth General Medical Education Program, the University of Minnesota Medical School, to the Office of Higher Education, and it is for both nurses and physicians to have more slots to be graduating from our systems. And I do have...
Welcome, Senator Rosa.
I do have a copy of a recent report that was issued by the University of Minnesota. It's entitled Primary Care in Minnesota, an Academic Health Center Perspective. And we made copies for your committee.
And we have those copies somewhere?
Ready?
In our packet.
Oh, I looked. I didn't see them.
It's accompanied by a letter from Dr. Sarah, and I'll just read a short part of the letter. It says, in order to make significant improvement to the quality of primary care in Minnesota, we will need new models of care that engage interprofessional teams of health professionals working at the top of their license.
Did everyone get one?
New partnerships among all stakeholders and robust educational opportunities in rural and underserved health care. So while the report calls for new primary care slots to be created in our higher education institutions, it also acknowledges that the delivery system needs to change, and that is in part what this bill is about. Allowing, creating, reform of the payment system to create medical homes, teams of professionals that will provide care management to some of the people with the most chronic illnesses in our state. So So we think the bill is right on, and without consulting Dr. Sarah Sotou, and so this part of the bill that is before your committee, Madam Chair, would appropriate amounts of money to create additional primary care physician and nursing slots. We are not sure how much should be provided here because we're not, we haven't exactly gotten a fiscal note from the, any of the systems about how much money is needed per primary care physician slot or nurse slot that's created in the system. And I might add that this fund is not in existence yet. The bill has to pass, and we have to start seeing savings before we have anything recaptured. So my suggestion is that we wait to fill in the blanks till we get to the full finance committee with the assistance of new staff, and that we add language to this section of the bill that says that this appropriation only is available if funds are available as they're made available to the Health Savings Reinvestment Fund.
John, we need to get that written up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have anybody to do it right now. It's missing. Senator Berglund, I have a question, though, for you. Can you find John? Okay. All right, maybe he'll be here in a minute. On line 1413, you say that the purpose is to increase the number of graduates of residency programs who practice primary care. Now, you know, my division subsidizes family practice residency programs at a rate of $20,000 a resident. And we've kind of worked hard over the years because it was very much kind of a hodgepodge in terms of how much money each program got, and you know, some programs didn't get any money and some got more than others. And so it goes to a residency program at Mayo, at St. Cloud, the hospital in St. Cloud, and at United Family Practice, which is an Allina program. And then through our University of Minnesota appropriation, the residency subsidy got kind of rolled into that. So I just wanted to make sure as I looked at your bill, and we chatted briefly, and you said that this money is more for medical education, not for the residency program. But I was a little confused when I looked at 1413, 1414, because it sounded like it was for residency programs, according to that line.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we're not exactly technically correct in how we have this language, but the idea here is to create more slots in the medical school and thereby create more graduates of the residency programs who practice primary care. So the idea is not just to create more medical slots so that we can have more cardiologists.
Right.
It is to have people graduating and, you know, completing their residency in primary care.
I understand. And I guess my purpose here is I just want to make sure that you're that all the residency programs are equally eligible to residency programs in primary care are equally eligible to receive subsidies from this program, because we've really tried to do that in our division and kind of be fair to all of them. Because, for example, United Family Practice didn't receive any subsidy for 10 years, and they had one of the premier residency programs.
Right.
So
this bill is aimed at starting at college level, where people would be beginning their education toward becoming a primary care physician.
Then, Senator Berglund, I guess
maybe we're not saying this right, but
maybe you need to. Then you either need to narrow it or broaden it. You either narrow it to say graduates of medical school who intend to practice primary care, or broaden it to have kind of a category where residency programs in general would be eligible to apply for the money, for example. So it's whatever your purpose is, your intent is fine with me. I just want to be consistent and not say, okay, we're going to give money to this group and this group, but you know, not to this or this.
I understand what you're saying. I don't really understand how you get more primary care residents if you don't have more primary care slots in your universities.
Right. So I don't know if Mr. Fuller caught this.
We're starting at the beginning here by trying to get more slots at the universities.
So maybe, just maybe we take out the word residency program and we focus on medical school graduates.
That's fine.
I mean, I hate to do that because I would like to see help for the residency programs, but maybe that could be a later step. What I don't want to do is see some get the money and others not. So maybe Mr. Fuller could help me on 14, 13, and 14. Would we want to say the number of graduates of medical schools who intend to practice primary care or something? And on line 14, 17, a different way of saying graduates of medical schools who intend to practice primary care. Because you're saying graduates of residency programs all the way down. I guess it's also on 1420. So I understand what you're saying. You have to go to medical school before you're in residency. But it's not clear to me. There are different entities. That medical school is a different entity than a residency program. Sometimes they're the same. I mean, it could be both University of Minnesota. But sometimes they're different. And so it's a different entity that would be eligible for this money. So you want to set this aside for a minute while we figure this out?
Madam Chair?
Senator Sharon.
I understand what you're focusing on, but I wonder if we do want to change that language because if you say that they're graduates of residency programs who practice in primary care.
That's not it.
Then it is assumed that they, as they go through the medical school, that they're engaged in an educational program towards primary care. And then the residency, that really drives home the fact that you don't initiate using the dollars for medical school and then not go into primary care.
That's my concern, too, Chair and Senator Sharon, is that at the medical school level, people still have a lot of options for what they do ahead of time. We really want this money focused at creating more slots in the university systems for people who are going to become primary care physicians.
So, Senator Berglund, it's not a problem for you have the University of Minnesota and you have Mayo Medical. It's more a problem for the residency programs at St. Cloud and United Family Practice that are not because they partner with a medical school. They deliver the residency program. They don't deliver the medical school part.
Right, but...
But you need both.
Right. I don't understand how we get them more primary care physicians in the residency programs if they're not getting more slots at the university level.
Right, I agree.
Okay.
I agree. That we need, you know, I'm not saying you switch to the residency program, I'm just saying you probably need to include them. Okay, Mr. Fuller is going to work on that.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
I just want to restate that I think we have to be careful that we don't just focus on the medical school slots, because those medical school slots can go to after medical school into any residency program. So I'm certain that the language here is intentional in terms of reflecting residency programs directed at practice of primary care. I think we cannot lose, in trying to achieve the focus on the medical school slots, lose that portion that means that they're directed towards primary care residencies. I just want to repeat that emphasis.
Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund and Senator Rosen, I just want to comment on just this general provision. And one of the questions that has generated through several of the committee stops or the dialogue on this overall bill is, how does this fit into, or how does this help that problem that we are increasingly seeing, particularly outside of the metropolitan area with regard to primary care physicians. And this aspect of the much larger health reform bill is a really strong component that really speaks to outstate Minnesota. And so I think that it's worth focusing on because there is a shortage already. This component of the bill seeks to address that and ties in nicely with the overall direction of the overall health care reform.
Right, we are trying to do more loan forgiveness also to help more graduates be able to be attracted to underserved rural parts of our state. We don't have enough graduates, then what happens is rural areas of the state are the first ones where the shortages appear.
Senator Berglund, we obviously agree because this division has been funding these residency programs for primary care physicians for before my time. I don't know for how many years. Senator Berglund, Senate Council would like to spend a little bit more time thinking about this. If it's okay with you, would it be okay if we had we worked on it a little bit more, that we're clear about what your intent is, and move your bill along, and maybe have maybe come up with some better language for full finance committee.
Would that work? Okay.
Are there any other questions or anyone in the audience who wants to testify on this section of this of whatever this bill is? 3099. Anybody wants to comment? Members? All right, then. Would someone like to make a motion? Send it to full finance.
Make a motion.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate file 3099 be recommended to pass and be referred to full finance. Is that correct, Senator Berglund?
Well, it's kind of floating between
divisions.
So
it's still in full finance. It never really leaves.
Yeah.
Or can we make a motion to send it to your division?
I don't know.
I think we send it to full finance, and then they give it to you.
Today. Yeah. Okay. That's
okay. All those in favor say aye. Senator Senja.
Madam Chair, and would it be whether a recommendation or at least or a footnote that this issue that council is going to be working on is addressed?
I think Senator Berglund agreed that we would work on this language to clarify if the money is just supposed to go for medical school slots, or if it could be used for medical school slots and residency slots. Okay. All right. The motion. You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Senator Clark, are you ready to go, or is she? She's not here. Senator Wieger, why don't we just take your bill? We can spend 10 minutes there. Let's go. Senator Wieger, and I understand that you've been working with interested parties and the stakeholders, and you have a A3 amendment.
And, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Is this considered an author's amendment, then? Since you kind of came back? Well, let's just consider it an author's amendment.
Okay.
All those in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Wieger,
yes,
could you explain what you did?
Madam Chair, division members, at the previous meeting, I provided background on P16 consoles in the country as well as the efforts that have been done in Minnesota. There were questions regarding the impact of this bill with the existing P16 group. You suggested that we get together. We've done that, and there in the proposed A3 amendment is the agreement that we reached. It accomplishes the objectives that I had, that there be legislative involvement in a P20 education partnership. It has a representative from the majority and minority parties in each body. It also has a reporting relationship to the legislature. The concerns of the existing P16 council were legitimately stated that we weren't going to legislatively pile on a lot of new members and make that subject to discussion each session. So what we have here is a provision that the group, by two-thirds majority vote, could add members. And in fact, they just have reached an agreement to add early childhood representation. And I have a letter if you'd like to see that. But we're working in that spirit of cooperation, and the lead participants in the partnership would be prepared to offer a statement if needed. Otherwise, we've reached an agreement. I'm happy with that.
Okay, is anyone in the audience wanted to comment on the Senator Wieger's bill as amended with the A3 amendment that maybe is in disagreement? Then we're going to assume that we're all kumbaya on this.
And Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to move that Senate File 2370 as amended be recommended to pass and be included in our committee's omnibus bill.
2942.
Okay. Yes.
Yep. It's a higher ed thing, too. Questions, Senator Roebling?
Senator Reed, have you been in Senator Rest Committee yet?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes. And
it's going tomorrow.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'll be there tomorrow with the policy omnibus bill, but this bill has received blessing in terms of the appointment for the senators and the representatives. So they have already signed off on that provision.
Senator Wieger, they saw this version?
Madam Chair, they saw the version at 1.12 to 1.16, but to make sure they will see it again
tomorrow
at midday.
It's on the agenda tomorrow as part of his policy.
But Senator Rest is aware of it.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Wieger moves that Senate File 2370 as amended be incorporated into the omnibus bill 2942. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wieger. Senator Clark, are you ready or should
I
we?
I am ready.
All right. Good. We have another negotiated.
Hey, Madam Chair, there is a delete everything amendment, which is the A1, but it doesn't actually say delete everything. So it is a delete everything, and this is the actual provision I'd like to bring
forward. A2.
A2, sorry. Didn't know we actually got it done all the way. Never mind.
This is, so we don't have the rider language in that. That's our opinion.
And Madam Chair, since the other is done as rider language, I don't know if we technically need to do something different.
Only when we take up our omnibus bill, because I think it's in the draft. So, Senator Clark, what have you done?
Madam Chair, do you want to put this on and then I talk about it?
Okay. Senator Clark moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Well, Madam Chair, what we were trying to get at is last year, after we were done with the higher ed bill, I and my House members were visited by several members of the faculty at St. Cloud Technical College. There was a limitation included in the conference committee report in our final bill that put limitations both on four-year and two-year programs, trying to get a handle on cost to students. And as a parent who has two college-age students with rather hefty costs, I can appreciate that, as can my sons. But one of the unintended consequences is, at least as it relates to the AAS degrees, is that in order to be competitive within our state, within the jobs they want, and looking at what programs have around the country, that none of them actually can get by with 60 credits. Now, we can tell them, and it's appropriate that they're looking at it, but a number of things have gotten to the point, if you even think about with some of the auto mechanic kind of things, between what computerized programs there are, among others, there just have been some issues. So we were requested to really look at this issue. And while there was a way that you could actually ask for a waiver to this limitation, if you think about it, that means every single degree program, every single AAS at every single technical college around the state separately would have to try to get a waiver. And that, frankly, seemed fairly bureaucratic and ultimately could cost more money. What we have agreed upon, though, at this point, and again, this was not a Senate position to begin with, is that Minsky, I know, is trying to figure out how to streamline this. So to have them come back, having told us and reported next year about how they've streamlined it, but also just broadly, it would be good for us to know how many different programs and how many different degrees across the state are asking for these exceptions and why. So that's what essentially the amendment would deal with. It doesn't change anything right now. The 60 credit cap and the 100 credit cap, would stay. That was not a Freudian slip.
Sure was.
Gotta love recorders. Would remain in place unless you go through the waiver process. But my understanding at this point is there's nobody objecting to it. And I, for one, think it would actually give us valuable information so we can know, are we having people graduate with the things employers want, and are we doing it in a cost-effective way? So I'd like to, Madam Chair, I don't know if there's any questions.
Any questions from members of the committee on the report option? And we did have some people who signed up to testify, but I understand you're no longer interested in testifying. You're certainly welcome to if you'd like to.
Otherwise, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 3485 as amended be passed and be included in the committee's omnibus bill, and I do not remember what the number is.
2942. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you for your work, Senator Clark. Okay. Senator Hahn. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam. And members. Thank you for having us on short notice, and we appreciate your busy schedule. We'll try to be relatively brief. I have Senate file, what is it? Where's the number?
It's 3623.
I'm sorry. This is a bill that has to do with the it's amending the Data Privacy Act of Minnesota. And the purpose for this is, unfortunately, as we've known from reading the paper, that there have been a number of unfortunate accidental deaths involving college-age students as a result of over-drinking or some other kind of drug use, mostly drinking, I believe. But the point is, these have been very tragic instances. And right now, the colleges and universities have a little bit of a quandary. It would be of an advantage, we believe, to allow schools to talk to families, talk to parents, if they believe that their student has got some problem or is in violation of law. But that's not being done right now because of a perceived conflict between what our Minnesota law allows and what the federal law allows. And without getting into all the details, I think this is going to have to go to Judiciary Committee to talk about data privacy, but the federal law does permit institutions to communicate with parents when there is a violation of law or policy of a school. The Minnesota's laws on data privacy, data practices, were adopted before that amendment was made to the federal law. And so there is at least a perception of an inconsistency. And so what's happened is that the universities and colleges have felt reluctant to try to communicate to families when they have a student that is knowingly or they come to know has been violating the law or the policy of the school with respect to alcohol or other controlled substances, and so they've been reluctant to communicate with families. And we think that if we could make this change, that it would then encourage and permit those institutions to do so, and we think might help save some lives and intervene in some tragic situations. So the bill, very briefly, on page one, this is a reference to the federal code that I referred to where it permits the institutions to communicate with the families. The bulk of the bill is the exceptions when private data is allowed to be disclosed. The last page, page 3, there are three exceptions that are being added. The first one, paragraph O, is when it involves a crime of violence or a sex offense. Paragraph P involves registered sex offenders. And paragraph Q is the one that we're primarily interested in talking with you today. And that is the one that would specifically permit a higher education institution to communicate with families of students when there is a violation of policy of the institution or local, federal, or state law with respect to the use or possession of alcohol or controlled substance. And it does make reference to the federal statute. And so I'd like to invite some testimony from, I think, Moorhead, the college in Moorhead, University in Moorhead. And so go ahead and...
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, my name is Suzanne Williams. I am assistant to the president at Minnesota State University in Moorhead, and my role at the university has been primarily for the last 5 years to guide our campus's responses and intervention practices with regard to alcohol and other drug issues. I also lead a community coalition in our community in Moorhead that addresses alcohol issues. I'd like to concentrate most of my comments with regard to the parental notification piece that's being proposed here, and I'll make several points. The first of which, at its most basic level, this bill is being introduced to clarify and update Minnesota data practices, so it's in line with what was intended in 1998 when FERPA was updated, that clearly states that college campuses may notify parents of students under the age of 21 when they have violated the law or any policy concerning the use of possession of alcohol or controlled substance. So at its most basic level, that's what this issue is dealing with. Now, certainly, colleges and universities in our state could adopt a policy procedure where they would allow students and their parents to sign a waiver allowing the institutions to share information like this. But the problem is that colleges and universities are quite frankly concerned and confused because you've got state law versus federal law saying what appears to be two different things. Second, parental notification has been shown to have positive impact on college campuses that do use it. For example, in a 2001 analysis of colleges and universities, researchers found that the judicial officers who were using parental notification as part of their responses, more than half reported positive results, with 39.7% indicating slight and 12.7% indicating significant reductions in the number of alcohol violations following the implementation of the policy. And the same study found that institutions such as the University of Delaware, Texas A&M, Bradford University, Utah State, Ohio University in Athens, and Penn State all experienced reduced rates of recidivism after they began notifying parents of violations as part of their overall campus's alcohol and other drug prevention efforts. Additional positive results included fewer suspensions, less vandalism, higher retention rates, fewer hospitalizations, increased upper-class students of interest in living in the residence hall. So in short, parental notification, when it's used on other college campuses as part of their overall prevention efforts, works. Third, campuses need to have the option of involving parents as partners in helping their students transition into independence. We all know that students experience tremendous growth and maturity as they grow through college. But they don't do it completely in isolation, and they certainly don't do it completely on their own. Today, the relationship between students and their parents does not automatically end when they begin school as freshmen. Instead, that relationship can be considered by many of our students as being one that's 24/7. We see it all the time on our campuses where students are immediately meeting with the business office or a faculty advisor and then pull out the cell phone looking for guidance from their parents. Further, we know that literature on student development supports what we're seeing on the campuses, that transition into independence and maturity seems to be taking much longer. So let's not ignore that reality when it comes to alcohol and other drug issues on our college campuses. When students find themselves getting into trouble or struggling with alcohol and other drugs, colleges and universities need to be able to and should be able to involve parents and use those individuals as resources as we search for the best ways to address that young person's needs. And by the same token, such policy would have to be used by officials with discretion because certainly abusive or dysfunctional family situations would be counterproductive to getting a student help. At the same time, we know that not all parents may want to know when their son or daughter violated an alcohol or other drug policy. Some campuses have dealt with this across the country by allowing the parents to sign a waiver and opt out of that individual campus's parental notification policy and procedures. The last point I'd like to make is that it's important to realize that drinking experiences of our students are different than they were 10 or 20 years ago. While the majority of our students are certainly responsible when it comes to alcohol, about 40% engage in high-risk drinking. And those students not only place their own lives and their education at risk with those decisions, they are impacting the entire campus and the larger community with vandalism, disruption, the mess, aggression, and violence. Our responsibility at institutions of higher learning is to keep our students focused on learning. For this particular group of students, the drinking practices are different from what we may have experienced while we were in college. Research shows that many of these students choose to drink hard alcohol over beer. They drink very quickly, and the sole purpose is getting drunk. Research shows that 20 years ago, 20% of males and 15% of females drank for the purpose of getting drunk. And today, when that question is posed to our students, more than 40% of males and more than 30% of females drink to become intoxicated. Further research also shows that there's increased polarization. More students are abstaining from alcohol, while more are considered to be those super at-risk, high-risk drinkers, consuming 15 or even 20 more or more drinks in a sitting. Those are the students that are drinking themselves to death. While the number of students who engage in high-risk drinking has remained relatively steady, the students who drink in the high-risk ways are doing it in more damaging ways. And such changes in drinking behaviors demand new strategies for colleges and universities to address the problem. And parental notification is one of those key strategies that has been shown to work. During this academic year, we know that our state has experienced far too many deaths of young people because of alcohol. St. Cloud, Winona, Mankato. In Moorhead, in my community, 4 years ago, the subject was pushed into our public conscious when Jason Reinhardt died after trying to celebrate his 21st birthday with a power hour. And then 18 months later, Patrick Kaisha drowned in the Red River after partying. High-risk drinking should not be the defining factor of our communities, and it certainly should not be the defining factor for our state. It's time to let our solutions define us, and it's also time to let parents be a part of that solution. Thank you.
And Madam Chair and members.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you. I think it's important to recognize that this bill is not dictating that institutions do anything. They do not have to do anything under this policy. It doesn't say that they must start a communication program in any way. It doesn't say how that communication program has to be done. It's simply a desire to clarify the law so that there is not the perceived conflict between Minnesota statutes on data privacy and the federal law, which I think in this case has been a little bit of an inhibition that has prevented institutions from sometimes taking some action which they might otherwise have done if they would have felt that they might not be subject to a lawsuit if they did. And so I think many of us have been in college. I was at one time, and I have two students in college today. And I would certainly, as a parent, would like to know if my kids were in trouble or having some kind of difficulty, I'd like to be able to help them. And I think most parents would feel that way. And it's tough. I realize that for students, this is kind of perceived as a intrusion into the lives of people who are, if not quite adults, are on their way to being there. But I think if you're not 21, you're not a legal adult. If you're violating the law or violating the rules of the institution, those are things that an institution should have the ability to address in a way that is meaningful. And I think that the passage of this would help them do that without risk of some potential liability. Thank you.
Senator Hahn, I have to admit that I'm a little confused because as I look at the bill, it looks very different from the title, which says an act relating to higher education. But as I look at the bill, it's really a data privacy issue.
And yes.
Perhaps, I'm not even sure if we have jurisdiction here. It seems like it is much more of a judiciary issue. it's up to the members, but I'd be inclined to just send the bill to judiciary without recommendation.
And Madam Chair, that's fine. I think that because it does pertain to higher ed institutions and how they may choose to govern, I think that there was at least a desire to make this committee aware, but you could very well be right that this is primarily a judicial issue.
Questions from the committee. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I would tend to concur with the Chair's suggestion, but as long as we are here, is there a reference in this bill? You talked in your testimony a lot about the desire with this legislation to communicate with parents. Is there a specific reference, I didn't see any specific reference to parents, and I'm wondering if, are there, I don't know, other entities or other individuals that might be eligible to receive the same information other than parents? That's my first question. And my second question, if I may, is I'd be interested to know if either one of our public institutions, either the university or Minsky, have a position on this bill.
Madam Chair, just Senator Lynch, thank you. This is a data practices, data privacy section of the statutes. And what it's doing is saying that the data has to be treated as private data with some exceptions. When is disclosure permitted? And that's what this is. It's listing when it can be permitted. And if you look over on lines 3.8 to 12, which is the part that says that private data, which is educational data or data about a student, can be made to a parent of a student in an institution of post-secondary education regarding the student's violation of any federal, state, or local law, or of any rule or policy of the institution governing the use and possession of alcohol-controlled substances. So that's where this gets at. This data can be released and only released to the parent. And so if it's not listed as an exception, then this private data cannot be released. It can only be released to the exceptions that are listed in this law. And there are others that aren't necessarily pertaining to this particular circumstance. But the reason it's important to include this is that right now institutions feel constrained that they – if they did release, if they did call a parent and say, gee, we think your son or daughter is violating some laws or our policies with regard to drinking, they could find themselves subject to a lawsuit by saying, wait a minute, that's not permitted under our Data Privacy Act, and you have released that information that is private data, and so therefore there's a certain liability risk. Now, what we believe, and we think the federal law, the FERPA laws, are pretty clear that the federal law says that's possible to do that, but we have a perceived conflict with Minnesota law. And so that's why we want to try to get this to be changed.
Senator Roebling.
Do you know if other states, because they don't have the same law as Minnesota, and they may be going under federal law, but they may also have their own state laws, do you have any idea how many other states are using the federal law to interact with parents?
And Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I do not, and maybe Dr. Williams knows.
I can't give you a definitive answer on the number of states, Madam Chair, but I can give you a list of institutions, for example, that have been cited in the research that I've consulted. University of Georgia, University of Rhode Island, University of Missouri, University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, Texas Tech, Ohio University, University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, Penn State, Texas A&M is just an example.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And I guess I appreciate Senator Hand's effort to just permit this. He's not mandating that any institution actually implement that policy. But, you know, what struck me as you were talking about this is last year we passed the provision, and we've had in law a long time, that if you had a student who was under 25 could stay on your health insurance. And last year we said it didn't matter if they were on your health insurance or not. And so in some respects, we are making families responsible for their young adults' well-being. And they end up carrying their young adult children on their health insurance. And I know that sometimes things come to light to parents because of that. My daughter was an RA in her college, and she had problems with students drinking, of course. And one time there was a student so intoxicated she had passed out and was unable to wake her up. So she called 911 and the ambulance came. And, of course, her parents found out because there was this big medical bill that came to them. And, you know, but that was important for that student because then her family knew. And they did intervene and helped her get help. So, you know, I really am supportive of your effort here, and whether or not the colleges and universities take advantage of it is up to them, and they can have that debate among themselves. But I think it is important to clarify that what our law is, and so we don't have a conflict with federal.
And Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, thank you. I appreciate that. And in my own family, we had an experience with our oldest child that, not in college, but prior to that, got involved with some drinking. And it took us a while to find out. And we were able to get her some help, and she's just fine now. But we all know that so much of our adult habits get formed at that early age, whether it's late teens, early 20s in this environment. And sometimes our judgment is not what it should be. And I say that, pointing at myself. I know when I was in college and I interrupted my career and went in the Army and I went over to Vietnam for a year and I came back and I was 19 years old when I came back. So I'd been 2 years in the Army, a year in Vietnam, and came back to college and I wasn't permitted to drink. And I really felt that was an injustice. I couldn't go down to the local bar and have a beer or whatever. And of course, in the Army, on bases, you can do those kinds of things. And not that I'm saying I did or didn't. I'm just saying no one could. But at any rate, I know that young people struggle with this, but we don't always exercise as young people the judgment that maybe we would as we were older, and we just want to make sure that young people get a chance to get older.
Senator Lynch, and then I'd like to hear from the student organizations. Senator Lynch.
Oh, I was ready to move the bill.
Oh, sure. Not quite yet.
I want to know if any of the student organizations want to chime in here. Yes. Mr. Brandt. Maybe could you move over a little bit and we can get Mr. Allen up there, too. Welcome, as always, to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jordan Brandt, the Vice President of the State College's Student Association. I've distributed a memo, and I don't necessarily want to read all of this to you, but, for us, this is mainly a data privacy issue. We've all, heard about the tragedies around the state, and something that I'd like to point out is that this is a statewide and it's also a national issue, and I think it's disproportionately linked to college and university students. The problems associated with substance abuse and alcohol abuse is not unique to students in any way. This is something that's going on all over the country with all types of people. And fortunately for us, it does garner much more media attention when it is, in fact, a student that has a tragedy like some of the recent ones we've seen. And that just gets more attention than it does when it's the average citizen. But this is not something just specific to us. There's no denying that this culture of alcohol and substance abuse, requires serious discussions and actions. But we're not sure that this is the right way to go about it. And something, as this affects our two-year system very differently than it does the university system. We also think that this really wouldn't do much of anything for our students. Our average student age is 27. Notifying the parents in that case would only apply to an extremely small part of our student population. And also, a great deal of our campuses have no dormitories. They're commuter campuses. It would be hard for an institution to know if this was indeed going on, and attempting to try to track that off-campus activity of students, while also, possibly violating their privacy, also could be expensive for institutions and requiring additional resources for them to do this kind of tracking. And we all know that there's a real problem with the cost of education, and we really wouldn't want to see anything that would increase administrative costs at institutions, or something that even has the potential to do so at this time. This sort of one-size-fits-all solution certainly doesn't work as it applies to the two-year system. There are some options that we think could be dealt with better, namely, increased informational campaigns on campuses, educating students that are available to them, making sure that students are able to see warning signs associated with these type of problems and know whom they should be getting in touch with. And, there are current procedures available for students to opt in to release this information. And that's just like when students do that for the release of grades and other financial information. But, you know, we think that students that are 18 that are adults should be afforded the privacy rights as adults that aren't attending college. We don't think just because they're students that their rights should be garnered. And, you know, this just notifying parents doesn't get at the real issues surrounding substance abuse. So, you know, the real answer is sort of shifting the culture that we heard about today of binge drinking and substance abuse. So, you know, we don't want to demean the good intentions behind the proposed legislation. But what is ultimately needed to stem these problems is a more holistic approach that doesn't unfairly single out college students alone. You know, I just like everyone to remember that no group or individual cares more about the well-being of the students than the student associations do. And, you know, we'll happily do our part to help with informational campaigns, any kind of education piece. We're certainly happy to do that because we think it's something that could be effective. So we think that the alternatives that we have do a better job to attack substance use problems and also provide privacy rights adult students expect and deserve. Thank you, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Mr. Allen?
For the record, my name is Graham Allen. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota State University Student Association. Madam Chair, Senators, thanks for the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Seven State University students today. The issue of excessive drinking on our campus has been brought into the spotlight in the past several academic years in the wake of tragic events that have happened on our campuses. Even though we do not support the proposed legislation before this committee, we urge the committee and stakeholders to find other ways to approach and address this issue in a more comprehensive and thoughtful approach. Our organization's students have been challenged by campus communities, parents, and even some legislators to start in addressing these issues from the student perspective to find workable solutions and not just a top-down approach. We want to be proactive on this topic and feel that this legislation may not be addressing some of the more pressing concerns in regards to student underage drinking and the consequences that stem from this behavior. I'll try to be brief in some testimony, but I'd like to highlight a few things. I believe it was passed out. This is something that I think many of you have seen already, just kind of some of the highlights and things that we would like to see or think are important for our campuses. To consider in policy through the Office of the Chancellor and the Board of Trustees as opposed to direct legislation. To give you a little background, at least in our involvement in the issue, in late November and early October, myself and Jason Fossum, who is the Government Relations Director for MSCSA, had several meetings with Senator Sharon on this issue. And since that time, we happily invited Senator Sharon to attend one of our student conferences where students talked about this issue, and we're trying to discover what each campus administration and their student leaders were doing to address this issue. I think it was pretty informative. Senator Sharon can obviously speak on her own behalf and what she thought from that experience, but I think it was a good opportunity for everyone to figure out how campuses differently deal with this issue, what kind of education strategies are in place, what kind of policies work on each campus, how do the student governments address this issue. All those things were discussed. Obviously, the discussion doesn't end there, but I think it was a valuable opportunity, and I know that there have been community forums held in Mankato specifically addressing this issue and how to relate students with the community, how we can work on this issue. And I think those types of conversations are a good beginning. So after working on this issue for several months and talking to a lot of different stakeholders, we believe that recommendations for policy and educational strategies can reinvigorate these discussions and help further plans that continue to address this issue from a more comprehensive approach. And none of this is going to be a silver bullet, but we think if we can get the discussion out, which, you know, thankfully Senator Hahn and others have brought this legislation, which does bring this discussion up. It challenges us as student leaders. It challenges our campuses to be more creative and invest more in finding some potential solutions, and we applaud that. I think the highlights of some things that we would like to see and work through policy changes supporting a good Samaritan policy, at least at the universities. We have more traditional students, as Jordan pointed out. Doesn't necessarily affect them as much. But what that basically would do is it's a policy that is in place in Morehead State University currently, and St. Cloud State is considering implementing this as well. This policy allows for students to seek medical help for themselves or a friend in an alcohol or drug-related emergency and not face judicial punishment by the college or university. They're obviously subject to any kind of legal punishments that come about, but not necessarily face strict, harsh judicial punishment by the college or university. We need to encourage students to take action if they believe someone may need help. A lot of the conversations we talked about today were instances where it was one instance that led to potentially someone's death. There are two different issues. That's a very important one. We need to find ways to for those immediate situations to find some solutions. This policy encourages students to not worry, not have their first concern be whether or not they're going to get in trouble by the school, but to call for help and make that the first priority. And obviously the promotion of it is, look, this is what needs to happen. This is in the best interest of everyone involved. You don't need to worry about if you're going to get kicked out of the dorms. You don't need to worry about if you're going to get kicked out of school. Just call for help. This is one way that institutions across the country have used in that certain emergency situation. For long-term solutions, I think we're looking at creating more educational opportunities. As Jordan had said, I think we need to do a better job of incorporating experts in the field, as well as students, as well as community leaders, to start addressing how can we start addressing the issues of binge drinking, the culture of drinking, and the consequences that come from that. But this requires more resources. And unfortunately, when our budgets are constrained or are tightened, orientation classes and resources that do describe these or do provide services and education for students are often the first thing cut. And that's unfortunate. I think we need more education. We need to look at new, fresh strategies to find some ways to better educate students about recognizing signs of problems, encouraging peers to look after for each other, and tackle that issue. On the issue of parental notification, like I said in the beginning, we do not support the current legislation on the table, but we think a more appropriate compromise is to allow for alcohol offenses or drug offenses to be included with the existing waiver programs, where a student and parent can sign off, receive this information, and that protects the student's data privacy, as well as any outstanding circumstances based on the relationship of the two parties. And with that, I conclude my comments and stand for questions.
Thank you both for that very thoughtful presentation. And I'm sure everyone would agree that we're very pleased with the work that you're doing in this area. That's really important, because we certainly don't want young people to die as a result of lack of knowledge about the abuse of alcohol. I've been informed that Mr. Lopez is here from MNSCU. If anyone on the committee would like to hear does the board have policies, or is it campus by campus situation?
Both.
Mr. Lopez, you want to just tell us maybe briefly what MNSCU is doing in this area?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Mike Lopez, Associate Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs with Minnesota State College and Universities. Our board has not taken a position on this bill. Therefore, it is appropriate for individual colleges and universities to express their individual support for or opposition to the bill. And that's why President Barton asked Dr. Williams to the board and the Office of the Chancellor is very concerned about alcohol abuse issues and drug abuse issues. We have provided training for our colleges and universities on the issue. We have provided funding for each of the colleges and universities to conduct surveys of their students' alcohol behavior so that they could then develop programs appropriate to their individual student populations, as you might expect with the diversity of the colleges, a program that would be developed by Morehead State, Minnesota State University of Moorhead, is different from the kind of program that would be developed at Pine Technical College or Norman Daylan. So there are variations, but this is what we're concerned about when we are receiving reports from institutions about what they're doing.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Lopez, Senator Sentience?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness. Is the reason that you don't have a position because of just timing and the bill, and or did the board just choose not to take a position?
Mr. Lopez.
Madam Chair and Senator Sentience, I'm not really sure why the board did not take a position. It was brought up briefly during a discussion of a variety of different possible legislative initiatives that might be brought up during the session. I believe there was one issue that was brought up having to do with possible liability of institutions that adopted such a policy, and then if there were a lapse in the implementation of the policy, that might cause a problem. But other than that, there are specific other issues.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think this has been a very useful discussion. Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair, does this have to go to another committee?
Let's go to Judiciary.
Madam Chair, I think it's appropriate after some of the testimony I heard to move this to Judiciary without recommendation.
Senator Sharon.
I'd like to speak briefly. I know we're very brief. We're very short on time, but I have spent a lot of time on this subject, not only in my community, but with the student organizations, having met with them. And I appreciated the generosity of their time with me because of my concerns about this. And for those of you that don't know, addiction is a part of the specialty area in my advanced practice. So I'm very concerned about this and other substance abuse issues that affect everybody across the spectrum, not just focused on the student population. I believe that this legislation focuses on bringing the law in compliance, and that's the central point of this bill, is to put it into compliance, not direct the university system as to what they're supposed to be doing. I think it moves the debate then to the campuses, where the student organizations there and the campuses can engage in a dialogue about how each campus can address this issue in that particular sphere of influence. I have heard the students talk about a number of other issues that they'd like to see implemented that they think would be helpful to them, and I think we should be paying attention to that and engaging them in the dialogue. My request to them this summer was that they change their position of one of being reactive to what authority figures lay on them to one in which they say, what's our sphere of influence, what's our participation in this, and how can we change our own behavior as a part of the overall solution to the problem that needs to occur to change the culture that normalizes, even glamorizes sometimes, and sends a lot of enabling messages about the abuse of alcohol. And this issue is not just a student issue. It is reflected in the adult population. It's characterized as fun and enjoyable and normal. And it is a message that affects young people long before they get into the college ages. So our approach to this has to be much more comprehensive. But nevertheless, we need to do those things that we can within the various segments of the population through that continuum. So although action needs to occur at every level, I think initiatives like this have to be looked at as possible resolutions, particularly with the research indicating that it does have a positive impact. There are a number of other issues like the density of bars, the access to alcohol, the cost of alcohol, the modeling behavior they're seeing in adults, how the student leaders on a campus address each other, the messages of other students on that campus, the messages that they hear about drinking, and whether or not there is the strength in the student body to send an alternative message and to confront that. Those are all elements that will change what overall a problematic situation that ends up in very disastrous outcomes, because people are not completely clear about the toxic capacity of alcohol as a drug. So I really am appreciative of the work that these student organizations have done. I like how Senator Hahn has been able to take a look at this as a compliance issue between the federal and the state law, and that it allows the campuses and the students to continue to engage in dialogue about this.
Okay. Any other comments from members of the committee? Anyone else in the audience want to comment? All right, then.
Oh. Madam Chair, can I just,
Senator
and I'll be brief because I think we want to move this bill on. A couple of weeks ago, I attended a fundraiser for the Sobriety High School, and actually there's five of them in the Twin City area. And I didn't know about these kind of things, but, you know, a marvelous kind of program where, and certainly at the high school level, where parents and schools, and there happen to be charter schools, but coming together to pull the lives together for a lot of fine students. And then just sitting there thinking today, I was remindful of the fact that my college roommate was an alcoholic. We didn't know that, of course, at that time. You know, we had a lot of good times and probably did a lot of things we shouldn't have done. But, you know, he was an alcoholic. I wasn't. He had his hand slapped a few times. I didn't, by certainly the college dean. But I think about him in particular as I think about this bill. And I know that probably in his mid-30s, alcoholism was frankly detected in his life. He fortunately saved his marriage, but he lost 15 to 20 years of his life to a tragic disease, and it is a disease. And so I'm here thinking, you know, you don't have to maybe report everybody to the parents, but leaving some discretion for the colleges and universities to take a look at these cases on an individual basis, and as necessary or as indicated, notify their parents. I think there's merit to that. We might save an alcoholic living a life of despair and all that goes with that if we were to frankly identify some problems a little earlier and move that person through a system and with his parents on into some treatment. So I think there's a good merit to this, Senator Hand. Thank you.
Ms. Peterson.
Madam Chair, I'm Don Peterson, University of Minnesota. Because the legislation does not mandate every case, we don't have a problem with this. And in fact, we have people meeting actually today having a discussion on this very thing because it would be a tool in the toolbox for the student here.
And Senator Tomasoni has a motion that we refer 3623 to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, students. Okay. Have left on our agenda today is to look at the omnibus education bill, and we had started continued building it. So if you want to pull out the 2942, and you all should have a little summary. First of all, we did discover some sections that need to be saved for when we do our financial bill. We're going to do a finance bill, a higher ed finance bill, that will then be referred to full finance. So that means in the A3 amendment to 2942, which is a draft document that staff put together that we're going to go through. But to begin with, we're going to delete Article 1, because that has financial implications. We're going to delete Article 3, and we're going to delete Section 3 of Article 4. So would someone like to move that? These things will come back. Senator Lynch, these things will come back with the finance bill. Okay, all those in favor of those deletions from the A3 amendment to 2942, say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. Yes, Article 1, Article 3, and Section 3 of Article 4. And I'd just like to go through what's left to make sure that we've gone over it and adopted it. So Article 2 was the private institution regulation, and I believe, Dr. Weidman, we've adopted this into the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. Anyhow.
Okay. So then what we have left is on Article 4. Oh, that's Article 3. We deleted Article 3. Article 4. Section 1 authorizes the Office of Higher Education, the Department of Education, to share data to analyze instruction in school districts and delineates the data that can be shared.
And I just wanted to know from Ms. Hegard, is this the language in Article 4 that was approved by the Judiciary Committee? Could you come and tell us that? And if not, then we need that language. Page 15, Article 4.
Madam Chair, Susan Hegard, Office of Higher Education. I'm not sure whether this has gone to full judiciary. I know it went through Senator Olson's committee. It was Senator Bensold's bill, and that committee approved the language, but I don't know. I think there's another stop after that.
I think that would be fine, as long as the Data Privacy Subcommittee.
Yes,
we have the
committee passed the bill, this piece.
And it's identical to this language.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, then this. Do you want to say something? Oh, yeah. Okay, does someone want to move this language then into the omnibus bill? Senator Lynch moves Section 1 of Article 4 that be officially adopted. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Section 2. Oh, this was the language that the Terrell Clark bill. And this is identical to that what we had already adopted earlier. So this is official. Section 3 we deleted. And Section 4 actually is also deleted because that's related to the Clark bill, right? Okay. So we don't have much left, but we did add the P20. And I guess that was it. So are there any other amendments for this bill? We don't have any other amendments. Member Senator Wieger?
No, Madam Chair, I didn't have it formally prepared, but I just wanted to put out a possible concept for a report that the Minsky Board might give us. And if I could just read the intent and get feedback. It would direct the Minsky Board of Trustees to report to the chairs of the House of Representatives and Senate committees with primary jurisdiction over higher ed policy by November 15, 2008, regarding the cost per credit for students, including whether a school offers banded credits and its impact, banded credits, on tuition and the feasibility of requiring all schools to offer banded credits for students. Banded credits would be 12 through 18. Out of the 32 Minsky schools, I think there's 7 that would be 4-year, and 3, I believe, offer banded credits. And for those others that are a part of a Minsky system, for Minnesota students, there's a tremendous advantage. If you have banded credits, you can save thousands of dollars. And I've had constituents ask that question, so I thought it might be useful information. The University of Minnesota has gone banded credits, I understand, for all of its institutions, and the intent that to keep students in school and graduate on time. So that would be.
Dr. Lopez, do you know if this information already exists in terms of how many colleges, Minsky colleges, are offering credits? And why don't you come up to the table? And could you hear what Senator Wieger was saying? Is this information already available?
Madam Chair, the information is available. In fact, the information is contained in the Board of Trustees materials for March. In terms of the institutions that have been in tuition, with the differences between different levels of tuition at those institutions that have been in tuition at the other institutions, that is available. I'm not sure that we've done a study of feasibility of banded tuition across the system specifically. I know we may have touched on it. I can ask Associate Vice Chancellor Judy Borden provide that information.
To start with, Dr. Lopez, why don't you have her provide that information to Senator Wieger and see if that kind of meets his needs? And Senator Wieger, if that's not adequate, then because this is a cost issue, I think it would be appropriate in our finance bill. So
so we don't have to resolve it today. We can, I think, for our finance bill, we're doing, Ms. Ryan, next week. We're actually doing it probably next Tuesday.
Okay, Madam Chair, there's
next
not
Tuesday
a...
before Easter? But does Dick want us to have it to him before Easter? Oh, okay. We don't have to have it done before Easter break. So how does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds fine.
Okay. All right, great. Then would someone like to move the omnibus bill, and it goes to the floor? Senator Roebling. Well, Senator Roebling hasn't made a motion. Senator Roebling moves that Senate Bill 2942 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevailed. And the committee is adjourned. We'll meet on Tuesday. We have some bills that got taken off the agenda today, and we're going to hear from the governor's office on his proposal for balancing the budget. Have a good weekend, everybody. Well, we're all going to be here tomorrow. It's an easy bill.
I'll just wait to...